favourite classic errors in reading the Bible was highlighted by an elderly woman who was interviewed about her faith and her favourite part of the Bible. And we heard it earlier, which is why I read about Moses from the King James Version. And these are the words, "It came to pass." And the interviewer said, "Why is it came to pass important to your faith?" "Well, it's because we don't have to put up things for long, and God will help us till they pass." Does that sound reasonable? It sounds reasonable. But the phrase "wehi" in most contexts doesn't mean "and it came to pass." It means "next" or "and." And particularly if you read St. Mark or Mark's Gospel in the King James Version, you will find "he came to pass" a lot. And all he means is, this is what Jesus did next. This was next. It's actually used 65 times in the King James Version. So no wonder someone reading, or more likely hearing those words, took them literally. And by sheer coincidence, I read this book a couple of weeks ago. It's called Here One Moment, and it's by Leanne Moriarty. My dad used to say to my mum and me, "This too shall pass." We didn't find it helpful. In fact, I recall my mother stamping her foot over some baking disaster one hot Christmas day. It's based in Australia. Wiping her sweaty forehead with a tea towel and crying, "Oh, do shut up, Arthur. It won't beep pass until after I've done it all again." Every day that year, I woke up, cleaned my teeth, looked in the mirror and said, "This too shall pass." We heard earlier that even as the Gospels were being written, people were picking up the wrong end of the stick. And who can we blame for that? Me, and people like me, for not explaining and repeating that this volume isn't one cohesive story. I said earlier it was written over 1,300 years ago, parts of it, by 40 different people. Longer than that. I've obviously missed a zero. Don't worry about it. It was written a very long time ago. And it was on scrolls, because they hadn't invented books even. Now, I do truly believe that the Bible is the inspired work of God. But we need to understand exactly what we're reading. Let me take you to a bit of the Bible that we rarely examine, the book of Judges. The Judges were the people who tried to rule the Israelites between Joshua's leadership and the coming of the Old Testament kings. And believe it or not, in among the Judges there's Deborah, who, yes, was a woman. And we can read about her leadership in Judges 4 and Judges 5. Judges 4, the chapter, tells us the facts, the actual history. And chapter 5 is the same story, but written as a song or poem. Now, it can't be denied that the Bible has contradictions, and we need to learn so that we can smooth some of those out. For a start, historical and cultural settings have changed. A command or piece of advice in one setting doesn't apply in another. One of my favourites is from Leviticus, which means the book of the law, and it tells us that when we build a house, we should build a parapet round the edge of the roof. Why did they do that? Because their houses had flat roofs. Does it apply nowadays? Not here, it doesn't. I mentioned that Deborah's story is told in different ways, history and poetry. But the Bible contains books of law, censuses, that's what the book of Numbers is. If you do decide to spend 12 minutes a day reading through the Bible, give Numbers a miss. It really is just a list of censuses. And of course, prophecy. And the Bible we read has undergone a lot of translating and copying. And think how often we see errors in PowerPoint presentations, even when they're commercially produced. Let's look at Exodus again. from the Ten Commandments that Moses had on his tablets. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Let's jump into the New Testament. Some judge one day to be better than another, while others judge all day to be alike. Let all be fully convinced in their own minds. Why did that change? Well, back in the days after the Exodus, the people were fed by manna, and it was delivered double on the day before the Sabbath, so they didn't have to work to gather it, in accordance with the commandment that they were given, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. By the time the letter to the Romans was written, many people, as nowadays, had to work shifts and had to work on all days of the week. Take, for example, a Roman soldier, and we know some of them converted to Christianity. He didn't get every Sunday off. And you know, Christian preachers also have to work quite hard on Sundays. People talk about the genealogy of Jesus, but there are two. Both Matthew and Luke give us the lineage of Jesus, and it won't shock you from what I've said that they are completely different. And let me explain why. They're both true. But Matthew wrote to convince the Jews of the time that Jesus was the expected Messiah, while Luke was writing for the Gentiles. So they needed to emphasize different ancestors. Now, I'm sorry to tell you I could go on quite a long while here, but let me reassure you, it is okay to trust the Bible. I loathe the word tradition. Why? Because tradition stops us thinking. We just do things without examining what we're actually up to. And if you don't know the story of the cat and the draining board, I'll tell it to you over coffee. Did your mum, grandma or auntie go to church? And did she wear her Sunday best? And did she wear a hat? No? My point is blown out of the water. My mother-in-law wouldn't move out of the door on the Sunday without a hat, even if she was going somewhere other than church. Hats were a traditional part of going to church, and they still are in certain churches. So let's hear from the Bible and see how that tradition arose. Whoops, it's not there, right. I'm just reading it to you. Every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, for that is one and the same as if her head were shaved. That was written by Paul to the Corinthians. Corinth was a port, which meant it had lots of people coming and going. It was full of immorality and pagan temples. And the Greeks had even invented a word to describe those living in Corinth and that copied their ways as Corinthianize. It meant to live a life of luxury, sensuality, often with connotations of promiscuity or debauchery. And one of those immoralities was, of course, prostitution. And ladies of the night displayed their flowing locks to allure. Modest women wore their heads covered. Strict Jewish followers, even today, the women will wear a wig. And they often take the wig off in the company of their husband, and underneath they have gorgeous hair. But they don't show that hair to just anybody. I suppose it's a similar situation to Muslims today, where women wear hijabs or burqas to emphasize that they have not been Corinthianized. I think I like that word. I think I'll keep it. So the original context of women wearing hats and men not was to exclude sexual immorality within the church. And I don't think it worked, but there we go. Let's go back to the beginning of the Bible, where God created everything and saw that it was good. These are not rhetorical questions. What is in the first chapter of the Bible? creation. What is in the second chapter of the Bible? Creation. So, they both tell us the story of creation, and you know what? They're different. Let's just look very simply at when we asked the important bits of creation came to be created. In chapter 1, we're the culmination. We're on day 6. If you read the account in chapter 2, we created first. I'll give you a moment to pause and think about that. Somebody posted on the internet, this is me reading the quote, I'm sorry. Are the editors that did all this utter morons, or was there maybe some other understanding of sacred history going on and we're all missing the point? And the simple answer is that, like the genealogies in Matthew and Luke, they were written by different authors for different purposes at different times. And typical of many of our, well, all of the Bibles, Genesis 2 is actually the older account. And we know that because it used the name Yahweh for God. Genesis 1 uses the term Elohim for God. And Genesis 1 has a formal structure, if you think about it. This is the one we're familiar with. And it was used by the priests of the time to instruct the people who could join in with the line, it was evening, it was morning, it was the whatever day. Because before people could read, before they had anything to read, they learned by rote, and oral tradition was the only way to stick things into brains. I found a lovely chap on the internet called Peter Enns. He's a scholar and theologian, and he offers some help of how to get to grips with what's going on when we don't understand contradictions or anomalies. If I say I hate oatmeal and then turn to someone else and say I love oatmeal, I am contradicting myself. If I said 20 years ago I hate oatmeal and now I say I love oatmeal, I'm not contradicting myself. Rather, my view of oatmeal has changed over time. If I say I hate oatmeal, but my son says I love oatmeal, that would not be a contradiction. We're two different people voicing our opinions. And the Bible works more like the second and third examples. But the trouble is, we expect it to look like the first. And it doesn't. So what are referred to as contradictions are only so if you assume that the purpose of inspiration, however it works, is to align or override the down-to-earth different verses that we encounter in the Bible. And Peter Enns again offers a lovely summary of how we should approach inspiration. I wish we had longer because there's really a lot in this. Inspiration is a matter of faith, and no matter how fervently it's believed, that doesn't mean it's comprehended. The Bible we have is a diverse and complex literary product, not reflecting consistently one point of view. Because of number two, we can and should say that inspiration, however it works, must include in its definition the idea that the Bible was written and then edited by people living in and reflecting their particular time and place. If we believe that God inspired the Bible, we also need to believe that God is okay with how the Bible actually works, and therefore, by faith, so should we. Teresa of Avila was talking about prayer, but her advice applies to what we might consider to be the weirdities in the Bible. The important thing is not to think much, but to love much. The penultimate quote is from Madame Jeanne Guyon, who was a 17th century French mystic. If knowing answers to life's questions is absolutely necessary to you, then forget the journey. You'll never make it, for this journey is a journey of unknowables, of unanswered questions, enigmas. And the last quote of the sermon goes to Rowan Atkinson, playing the role of Walter Goodfellow, the Reverend Walter Goodfellow. Thank you, Nana.